Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. My program is titled World Watchers. It emanates from Pacific Grove, California, broadcast number 692, March the 11th, 1985. There is something nurturing in the background of all the things that I have studied or other people have studied and put together that is very disconcerting to me, but makes sense in terms of what is happening now with the power structure and why they are behaving as they are, because otherwise all of these various news things that I'm reading every single day and the exposés couldn't be possible if people really had their sanity, the people in charge of things at various levels of the government or as private individuals, but they seem to have negated their responsibility for what is coming down. And the only thing that I can figure out is that deep inside of the majority of people who could be in a position to speak up, this evil force has tapped that part of them that makes sense to them, and people are behaving accordingly in a selfish, self-centered way that has been described in a publication. It's privately published, but it's been sent to me several times, called the Black Fascist Power Report. Now, before the massacres at Jonestown, I had talked about those events on my program, weekly program, because I'm always studying political assassinations, and Jim Jones, with links to the intelligence community, was having members of Jonestown obediently sign confessions to murdering of public officials that had not yet taken place. And after studying the famous Oswald diary and Sir Hans diary and James Earl Ray's diary, these famous alleged loners that keep well-documented records to show their leftist leanings or their craziness, where they have contacts with high-up people in government or in fascist groups, I was interested in what was happening in Jonestown. And when the Turner Diaries were mentioned by William Pierce in 1980, I read about them because it was apropos of some shootouts and the Posse Comitatus, and I put that on the air. And 5 years went by before the Standard Press, the newspaper articles of the columnists would recognize the Turner Diary as being, in fact, a blueprint to kill all blacks and Jews in the United States and to even overthrow the government. Now, studying World War II, the fascism of Hitler and Mussolini, there have been thousands and thousands of books, you can't say how many, trying to define fascism or the appeal that Hitler had or the way he could take all of the countries that he did without much opposition and then after the war sweep them all up as his allies and bedfellows. It has to be more than just disliking the Soviet Union that people go to such lengths, because in studying Hitler's Germany, for the most part, they appeared like very good people that just did bad things. And when the war was over, that was the line we were supposed to remember. It happened now, but it's over, and we want to rebuild and join Germany with a democracy, whereas we're putting in the dictatorships all over the world. And it has to be more than saving the Vatican Empire and being the soldiers of Rome. The way that the people in control have been operating makes me believe that the explanation of what the black fascist power is taps deeper into people, because when I read their definition of it, and I'll just share a few lines with you now, I want to go on to some other material. It describes Ronald Reagan, it describes Henry Kissinger and Vernon Walters or Jean Kirkpatrick or J. Peter Grace or Claire Sterling or William Buckley or James Buckley or George Bush, and the characters that line our history books of this whole era, whether it's Richard Helms, Vernon Walters, the new UN ambassador, or William Casey, the power to do evil is so great. After the war, when the war was winding down, and I guess watching Hitler, but just it tapped the resources of people to know how much fun evil is, how many millions you can make, how many people you can hurt. And it became something beyond territory or boundaries. What I'm afraid of is that it doesn't have to be anything about wealth anymore, or communism or anti-communism. It just has to be the unleashed power of doing it, which is killing or hurting, just as the Soldiers of Fortune or the Gung-Ho may have been funded by agencies linked to Taiwan, Japan, to Chiang Kai-shek, to our police departments. How could this infestation get so much protection unless there was a common bond of suppression among the people who really jump at the opportunity to be as mean as they can be? And that's what black fascist power is. Nobody of any intelligence are opposed, no group is opposing these people, no university presidents, even Dr. Spock, who I quoted a week ago or several weeks ago, talks against atomic bombs. Nobody is figuring out who is running our lives and making the decisions to do such terrible things, and we are going into debt, tremendous amount of money, just to keep it up. The idea that it has to be kept up. Money, debts, pollution, billions of dollars to clean up what we've polluted already aren't significant. The fun of doing the kill and the chase seems to be the important thing. Now, this letter I got, the Black Power Fascist Group are from Minneapolis, and they just sent me a few statements. Well, it's about 30 pages. I'm going to share about three sentences or paragraphs with you. And they just said, describe black fascism as an appetite for absolute power. It overturns the social contract. It downgrades equality, justice, and freedom. And instead, it hammers out a single thing, the amoral will of the ruling elite, that might makes right. If we're strong, we're okay. That the weak are contemptible, and that the greed needs no excuse. Absolutely no excuse. So while you read that the amount of millionaires doubled in the last few years while Reagan was president, the amount of fascism and repression and problems going on around the world has also doubled. They quote a sentence or paragraph from Friedrich Nietzsche that reminds me of Henry Kissinger or Reagan or the people I mentioned. And it says the very what they do, the very meaning of it is their justification, doing what they want for themselves, not the community, but just in the act of doing it. For this reason, it must be ready to sacrifice without batting an eyelash a mass of people who must be, in its interest, in their interest, humiliated and reduced to the state of mutilated beings, of slaves and of instruments. Its fundamental belief, in fact, must be that society does not exist for itself, but is the substructure and the frame which permits an elite to elevate itself to a superior state by virtue of a higher mission or simply in its own interest. It doesn't even have to have that higher mission. Now, interesting enough, they list a whole section of their beliefs, but the one that caught my eye was belief number 5, that the victim is always wrong. And this is what the Black Fascist Power Report says. Invariably, at some level, the victim should have known what was coming. Suffering is traceable to ignorance, and ignorance inevitably, necessarily, and desirably leads to punishment. They're telling you right now, and I personally don't think I am ignorant, and I think I understand what's coming and am trying to share it with you and pass it on, but they have total contempt for people who can't even figure out what's coming, because they know, they even know in their own pamphlet that if you could figure it out, you could stop them. But as long as you work on terminology of, as I say, boundaries or wealth or define communism or say we have to have death squads because Lenin or Stalin killed X amount of people, therefore we do it, we have to have biological warfare because they do it. We have to be offensive and deploy Soviet missiles against the Soviets because they do it. We are using all kinds of words, and if you can't figure out that they're leading us to World War III and that they will be totally unmerciful to the native population at home, either before the war happens or after, then you're missing a certain point, just as I tried to warn earlier about the Turner Diary or what was going to come down in Jonestown. I had a wonderful meeting up in De Anza College with people who listened to World Watchers and David Emery and Nip Tuck up in that area, Cupertino, San Jose area. And I promised them I would give sources for a few things that I mentioned there, and I do want to get them on the air and share them with you also. One thing that I referred to was an article in the San Jose Mercury, Edwin Meese Lobbies for Reagan's Economic Plan. San Francisco, March the 2nd, 1985, Edwin Meese devoted his maiden speech as a U.S. Attorney General not to talk about law and order, but a plea for public support of President Reagan's economic program. He was speaking before a conference sponsored by the San Francisco-based Institute for Contemporary Studies, and that was set up for Edwin Meese in the first place by the Mellon Foundation, and this was one of the think tanks where he can cross back and forth across the country and give out his propaganda, and various people can do the same thing. It's Institute for Contemporary Studies. And it concludes what he was saying as the Attorney General, asking us to help with the funds when the man he's working with and has for a long time ran on the platform that he would balance the budget and then spent more than all the other presidents combined. Meese called for a constitutional amendment to require a balanced federal budget. Now, be warned, when once Meese and Reagan and the Heritage Foundation want a constitutional convention, they will put in a clause and make a foreign-born be able to run for president, and that will be Henry Kissinger. He's been waiting for that, and I've mentioned before that when he comes out to California for his annual Bohemian Grove 2 years ago when he came, they played Hail to the Chief, and these were the leaders of our country, and they meant it. So that the only thing between him and Hail to the Chief is the constitutional change. And I believe that the money can be spent like drunken sailors out on a binge, and that will create the excuse for the convention. And then Fritz Kramer, whoever he represents, whether it is Martin Bormann and the entire Nazi network of multinational corporations that all link together, they will be in when his puppet, Henry Kissinger, is president. And then, of course, people like Alexander Haig, another protege, becomes Secretary of State again, or the head of the National Security Council. Now, the other article about the Constitutional Convention, bringing it up again, that I know is the same week, for Reverend Moon's paper that works very closely with the White House, January the 24th, Constitutional Amendment on the Budget Gathers Force. And all of a sudden, they're bringing up this desire to have a change in the Constitution. And at that point, with the massive programming that they are doing all along these past few years, they will push Henry Kissinger as President of the United States. And because the Heritage Foundation is now saying, let's listen to him, he's great, and they're pushing Henry Kissinger. They pretended that they were arm's distance before because he was a left with the Rockefellers. It was all a crock of BS. And now this is something to watch, and we should alert our various congressmen. How would you vote if this were thus and so? And then get out some of the old tapes I did, or future ones or present ones, on Henry Kissinger. Now, Jack Anderson had one just yesterday that was a very revealing story about Henry Kissinger. Some of you don't get the Saturday or Sunday sections of Jack Anderson, but we do here on the Monterey Peninsula. This is titled New Spirit in India, March the 10th, 1985. It is reported that the position of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who recently paid a low-profile visit to New Delhi, has a message, bearing a message for Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi from President Reagan. According to diplomatic sources, Kissinger came away both impressed and enthused by Gandhi's new leadership. Kissinger reportedly gave Gandhi assurances of close U.S. support and cooperation, provided only that India refrain from anything that might seriously embarrass the United States on the eyes of the world. Now, the only thing that would embarrass the United States would be the truth that they had Mrs. Gandhi murdered, so that they could deal with the son, and the son got the message. Now, we have ambassadors to India, and we don't need Henry Kissinger over there assuring them that if you don't embarrass the United States, then in the eyes of the world, then you and I, buddy, will get along good. It's like a mafia boss giving the orders, you know, to the new kid around. Jack Anderson said New Delhi's realization of Kissinger's Metternichian handiwork, that's his favorite, Metternich caused relations between India and the United States to sink to an all-time low when Kissinger was in charge. This visit was Henry's mea culpa, one diplomat told my associate. After years of mutual suspicion, a measure of cordiality was restored following the 1982 visit to Washington of Mrs. Gandhi, and now her son will come to Washington. He's scheduled to visit here in June, and we'll tip the balance of power and say, don't have anything to do with the Soviet, and don't embarrass us in the eyes of the world, and we will treat you nicely. You know, remember what happened to your mom, and don't tell anybody about it. That's all that it can mean. That's what Jack Anderson wrote, and you can't take that article or the paragraph any other way. There's no other way to interpret it, because he has no way to embarrass us so much as that it's recently firing all his top aides, linking the connections to London, to the Kissinger associates, the people that Kissinger and Haig and Engelbert travel with, and even Jesse Helms and the travels in this country of the various Sikhs. So he's giving his terms. That is Henry Kissinger. Forget the ambassadors, just do the murders and send him around to do the clinging up. Just to get the good essence of Kissinger, I've had an article in my files for a long time, and I don't believe I've shared this with you. This is one from the New Zealand Press that Ted Rubenstein got. He goes to the library and gets these marvelous articles, and this came out in 1983 when people were being sentenced for the killing of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy. And this article came out, and it's titled Tough Talking. And a press conference was held on November the 18th. This is 1982. The article was written in January. Asking George Shultz a question about Dr. Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, who gratuitously gave Shultz a certificate of good character in his memoirs. Mr. Secretary, at your last press conference, you referred to your very high regard for Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, and I'm wondering if this has all been changed. This is after the trial of Moro. Shultz, I haven't changed my mind. Well, this is the other comment. Well, there have been some revelations coming out in the Italian courts that have reported over the Italian press, quoting Aldo Moro's closest friend, Mr. Gerzani. Moro, a former Italian prime minister, was abducted and killed by members of the Red Brigade. Now they're on trial for murder, but what is most intriguing about the press conference is that not a word about the evidence that Mr. Gerzani cited in the Italian courts and published in the Italian press was carried by the international news agencies who normally transmit the merest tit-tattle about personalities of a global reputation. Nor has there any notice been taken outside of Italy, which has its bureaus in Rome, the newspapers in Rome, the Corriere della Sera, reporting the trial in its issue November the 11th, said five witnesses referred to the encounter between Henry Kissinger and Moro in 1974 in Washington. None could provide specific details, but the paper said that day that Corrado Gerzani, one of the closest aides of Aldo Moro, declared it was a bitter conversation between Kissinger and Moro. I don't believe in dogmas. I'm not a Catholic, and I don't have confidence in your political approach, which is highly negative, Kissinger told him, pointing at the former premier. Their disagreement was very strong and full of resentment. In the following days, in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, Moro felt totally sick, Gerzani told the court in Italy. Gerzani maintained that Moro was widely regarded in the office of the U.S. Secretary of the State as incorrigible, pro-communist. They feared him. They thought he would condone and corrupt Italy, although he himself did not take part in it to weaken his party. Moro was president of the Christian Democratic Party. Gerzani told the Red Brigade trial Moro was upset, and at the end of his visit to the United States, he accused Henry Kissinger of being absolutely incapable of understanding the real political situation in Italy. By that time, Moro was strongly considering whether to withdraw from politics for life or at least 2 years, and at that time he refused to be nominated as prime minister because of threats that his family knew about to his life. Gerzani told the court that in 1978, Moro decided to make a clean break with his relationships with Henry Kissinger. He wrote an angry article against Kissinger, according to Gerzani, who advised Moro don't publish it. It would only worsen the situation. Gersani placed this article in the archives and gave a copy to Mrs. Aldo Moro after the death of her husband. It remains a mystery to this day. Gersani told the court that he spoke to Moro on the telephone of the evening of March the 15th, 1978, a few hours before Moro was kidnapped. Moro feared his name would be linked to the Lockheed affair and he would be identified as Antelope Cobbler, the mysterious middleman in the bribery scandal. Moro told Gersani, according to the evidence, that it was one of Henry Kissinger's men who accused him of being the Antelope Cobbler. Gersani said at the time of his kidnapping on March the 16th, Moro was carrying documents relating to the Lockheed affair. So the Lockheed scandal was the Central Intelligence Agency funding money to various agents and countries, particularly in Italy, and there were members of the Japanese government that got caught in the scandal, and also Prince Bernhard, and a lot of heads of states were touched, but we keep paying these heads of states to stay into power, no matter what the cost. And if Mr. Aldo Moro had evidence to prove Henry Kissinger a liar, that he wasn't that particular person, he wasn't going to live to talk about it, and he was immediately kidnapped, and the papers about Lockheed were taken from him, and I suppose were never recovered to this day. Because if the Red Brigade were really leftists, and think about this one, you know, a scroungy bunch of radical leftists, they would have used the Lockheed papers in the satchel of Aldo Moro and then exposed the corrupt Italian government for what it was, being paid off by America. But the Red Brigade was part of the CIA, just as our SLA was. It was a right-wing group, and therefore they disposed of the Lockheed papers and then killed Aldo Moro. There's quite a bit on the Korean airline in the newspapers these days because of the multi-million dollar suit against the United States government. And, of course, I watch it very closely because I wrote an article on the Korean airline, and I like to see some more pieces of the puzzle come in that I had figured out as early as a couple of years ago. This one article is from the San Francisco Chronicle, Air Force Destroyed Data on Korean Jet. And I got another one from the Chicago Tribune about the jet material being destroyed by our United States government. The Air Force destroyed the tape showing at least part of the radar track of Korean Airline Flight 007, which was shot down by the Soviet Union. How the Air Force came to destroy the tape soon after the disaster has become an issue in a lawsuit brought against the United States government. And according to testimony given in the U.S. District Court last week, the Air Force Regional Operations Command Center had tracked the flight by radar after it took off from Alaska, at least part of the flight. They're admitting part of the flight. The Air Force, which customarily impounds any information relating to aviation disaster, did not save the radar tape. Remember, this all sounds familiar. After you study the John Kennedy assassination, then all these other activities, assassinations follow, and the same pattern, modus operandi, takes place. When John Kennedy was killed, the autopsy papers were destroyed. John Connally's clothing was sent to the dry cleaner. The car was sent to Dearborn, Michigan within 48 hours. There are 27 pieces of information, hard evidence that was destroyed. But now we're back to the controversial Korean airline. I just want to say that my training for knowing how these things happen came by studying the Kennedy assassination. Jan K. Von Flattern, a Justice Department trial attorney, told the court that the radar data being referred to was just Air Force data, defense data, which is recycled every 15 days. He's implying it's just our Air Force. It has nothing to do with a member of Congress and a dual role as chairman of the John Birch Society. The tape on which it is kept is recycled every 15 days, and after some specific effort to preserve, Mr. McDonald Madole, an attorney for the family members who filed the suit, and everyone else, was told that such preservation had not taken place within 15 days of the accident. They had no idea why. Von Flattern added that officials at the center have said they did not see anything unusual in their scopes when the airliner was shot down, and were not responsible for keeping track of such outbound civilian aircraft. Attorneys for the family insist that the full story of the tapes destruction has not been told, and they want to talk more to the Air Force officials. In the court hearing, when Von Fladen was talking, he said the Air Force keeps their tapes 30 hours, not 15 days, as he had said earlier. He changed his mind and became reduced to 30 hours and not 15 days. And he said, in any event, we do not have them. We have not had them since shortly after the accident. Now, the Washington Post had a story February 24th, 1985, with regard to this lawsuit. The Federal Aviation Administration established a communication procedure in 1978 to notify the Soviet Union if an aircraft flying the North Pacific was hijacked and considered likely to enter Soviet airspace. So our excuse to not contact them was that we didn't have communication back and forth. We've had it since 1978, and they could have been notified. This particular lawsuit is being brought out, the Washington Post says, in the U.S. District Court here on behalf of the relatives and passengers who were killed. The FAA document shows, according to the motion of the attorney, Donald Medull, that specific arrangements for communication with the Soviet Union exist in anticipation of unusual aviation incidents. The document orders FAA controllers in Anchorage to notify controllers in Tokyo if there is any indication that the hijacked aircraft will enter USSR space. While there is no question that the Soviets shot down the airliner after it strayed into the Soviet airspace, there's been considerable debate about whether the United States military or intelligence sources were aware that the airliner was off course and they should have notified and warned the crew through the FAA. Now, this is a story in the Washington Post that there were means to communicate with the Soviet Union to stop this incident from happening. So why did we let it happen? The why I answered in my article in February 83 in Hustler. I wrote in 83, it was February 84 that it was published. Now, there was an article in Der Spiegel that I might have shared with you, but apropos of this new material, I want to detail it for you, for new listeners, or in case I didn't have time to do it at length. This is a new study that was published in the German magazine Der Spiegel by Anthony Sampson, a well-known writer, investigative journalist, who has to be taken seriously because he has studied the intelligence community. He's the author of the book The Arms Bazaar, The Seven Sisters, and he covers a lot of credibility when he writes. This is the story. For the first time since the Korean airline flight was shot down, top officials of the Reagan administration now have become directly implicated in the incident. The German magazine Der Spiegel, by British journalist Anthony Sampson, said that the United States State Department, the CIA, the National Security Council, and the White House itself were fully informed of events as they unfolded and were deeply involved in the orchestration of everything from the false stories to the cover-up. The incident plummeted U.S.-Soviet relations to an all-time low, destroyed the arms control talks, led to the deployment of U.S. crews and Pershing missiles in Europe. The Reagan administration claimed from the beginning it had no idea the plane was more than 350 miles off course, in spite of the fact that there were numerous U.S. surveillance aircraft, satellite, surface craft, land-based radar all looking in the area through which 007 passed. It is further maintained that the United States intelligence agencies didn't know the plane was shot down until several hours after the tragedy, according to the New York Times, a statement made by Secretary of State for Canadian European Affairs Richard Burt, another co-worker and cohort of Kissinger, Henry Kissinger and Haig and Eagleburger. Der Spiegel's evidence indicates, however, that the United States, and Burt in particular, knew about the incident within two and a half hours after the downing, and Anthony Sampson charged that the administration leaked false stories that the plane was safe on the Sakhalin Island to give the White House time to prepare a propaganda blitz. The article, reviewed by writers David Hollander and Stephen Saint, was reprinted in the LA Weekly October 26, in case you don't have it. And they said the charges that the United States knew within minutes when the plane was shot down were, and the information was relayed to Japan and then to Fort Meade, outside of Washington, D.C. We'll take a one-minute break and just go back on this and the deception of the Reagan government, because in 1983, October 3rd, 1983, in my broadcast, I referred to the fact and went into the information that Catherine MacDonald knew that what was going on. She was in touch with the State Department and the CIA and having a telephone conversation, she and through her brother-in-law, Harold MacDonald, after the plane actually was down, they were working out some kind of a script. We'll take a break one now and then come back.